Nice to see those of you in the audience, and we hope that that your experience is worthwhile today. With that, I think we'll begin. Representative Nolan, did you have a comment or something to talk about?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I appreciate your accommodating a last-minute request. I'm delighted to present to the committee and welcome to the Capitol a group of students from Portland High Schools, from Lincoln and Wilson, and I think we have someone from Grant, too. They are here taking a day that they do not have classes in school because of in-service programs for their teachers, but they decided they would come here and learn a bit about the way the state government operates and tell us how we think it should operate with respect to schools. I appreciate your accommodating very brief comments from two of them. I'd like to bring to the table Chris Chamness. Chris is the student representative on Lincoln's curriculum committee, and he's the treasurer of the senior class at Lincoln. And James Williams, who is actually a graduate of the Portland Public School System, specifically Lincoln. He was last year the student member of our school board, and he is now at Princeton University.
Excellent.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Before you speak, please, for the record, indicate your name.
My name is James Williams, and thank you very much to Chair Beckland and the Education Committee for accommodating us. We're here basically to make one request of legislators today. We've come to the Capitol many times before, many times last year, and over all the special sessions because of our concern for education funding and the system of funding for public schools. And we really feel that in addition to things like Measure 28, which are short-term, temporary kind of band-aids, we are interested in a long-term solution. It's been many, many years. I remember my first trip to Salem in 1995, the 1995 session, to lobby about school funding, and it's simply gone on too long now. And we are requesting legislators to agree not to adjourn this session until you've approved a plan for long-term, adequate, and stable funding for schools. And both those are really key, both words, adequate and stable. As I'm sure all of you know, the school funding situation has been both grossly inadequate and extremely volatile. And those are two very important things for the health of our schools and for the future of Oregon, including to ensure a healthy economy and quality of life for all Oregonians.
For the record, my name is Chris Chamness, and again, I'd like to thank the chairman and the members of the committee for being able to hear us on such short notice. I'm going to keep my remarks fairly brief because I know you kind of worked this in. I'd just like to reiterate what James Williams said about the need for adequate and stable funding. As a member of the Curriculum Council this year at Lincoln High, I've had firsthand experience on how the inability to know how much funds are coming in from year to year can play havoc with the way that the schools try to organize their curriculums. And I see problems in various programs as ESL and other essential programs that the state needs to provide for students in order to have a literate and good citizen base for the future. I would also just like to mention that we as students are very aware that this is a very hard time for Oregon right now. Many of us who are here today stay up to date on the current economic situation. We know that money is limited. We feel that only increases the need to find a stable source, a dedicated source for the funding of education. We understand that money is tight. However, we feel that education is one of the state's top priorities, especially in looking towards the future, as the students of today will be the future workers and possibly members of the legislature tomorrow. So for those reasons, we very much urge you to keep this session open until some means of funding education on a stable basis can be established. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Mr. Chair, I might just say that these two gentlemen and all of the students who've come with them give us hope. And I would welcome any of them who would like to join us on this side in a few years. You are well spoken, and you make a very clear and effective point. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank
Representative
you.
Nolan, one additional point. You encourage one or more of these groups, these students, to perhaps be on this side of the dais, but surely not as opponents of yours. Wouldn't you say?
Mr. Chair, I don't expect to be here 25 years from now.
Just checking, okay.
Mr. Chair,
yes, I would represent Farr.
Express a hope that the students here will be able to get a much better job, paying job than we have.
Well, I would say that your presentation was obviously excellent, and we hear you loudly and clearly. I hope that we can come up with something that would at least be a step in the direction that you talk about. And I know that sometimes it's difficult to be patient. And you talked, James, about 1995 as your initiation into lobbying, so it hasn't happened yet. But I can remember probably in the 1960s or 1950s talking about stable long-term educational funding. So but we're working on it, so we'll do the best we can.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At some point we do hope we do get stable
right,
and adequate
right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, on our itinerary for today, we have the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators and the Oregon School Board Association. Are you coming up together, gentlemen? Okay, very good. Please, we're ready.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ozzie Rose with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and my colleagues told me that I could come and participate today if I behave myself and not talk too much. But I have something I'd like to share with you, and I think you just were handed a table. I'd like to share this with you in the context of trying to focus what we're really about when we set policy. This material is developed by our National Association, and it points out that what we expect of public schools as a society has changed, and that needs to be part of our thinking as we think through the issues related to funding or whatever else. And we tend to get focused on details, and I think that this perspective helps us think through that. And public schooling has been around, as you know, since the late 1700s, early 1800s in our country. And the mantra of public schooling, public education, was equal access. Everybody has access. And in the late 1800s, we first got the first public schools and out of Massachusetts, and we talked about every child having access. Now, every child then, by and large, was a white child of a family of some means, but it was supposed to be for everybody. And through the 1800s, early 1900s, the public schools are for everybody. They, in fact, not everybody attended, and we talk a lot about the history of our country, about our immigrant population, and how public education provided them the opportunities, and et cetera, et cetera. But again, the ones that of our immigrant population, the access was really available to, again, white immigrants who had parents who pushed and helped them and thought as important. We really didn't have universal access. We had the possibility of it, but we didn't really have it. And we didn't begin to address really widely the question of universal access until the 1950s, when we got the first court decision related to African Americans having equal access to our public education. And then in the 60s, we got the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, the first time as a policy we said that people with low incomes, poor people, have access, equal access to what public education provides. And in the 70s, we had Title IX, which we decided that women, you know, this little thing here says girls, I'll use the term women, but women have rights to things, athletics and so forth. And we also in the 70s had our first federal legislation regarding children with disabilities. So we spent 200 years of approximately really implementing or institutionalizing the concept of universal access. And now we've changed, and we want to talk about universal proficiency. Our policy in this country is universal proficiency. Every child will succeed. And we talk about No Child Left Behind as a federal mandate and something new, but Oregon has been well ahead of that. We had our approach to No Child Left Behind beginning in the late 80s and the early 90s when we adopted our Oregon Education Act for the 21st century and the two or three bills that preceded it. So what No Child Left Behind is asking us to do is really not different in many respects as a goal than what we've already placed in our policy in our state. Now, it has some details in it that are different and some punitive aspects, et cetera, but the concept or the policy about what do we expect of our schools isn't very much different, and we've been a decade or so ahead of them. Now, what does this mean to the decisions that you make and school districts make? If in fact, we are now interested in universal proficiency, every child will succeed, does that raise different issues than every child has access? Of course it does. Of course it does. And those are the issues that are before us. And we know some things about how kids achieve and that are related to this concept. What we know, some things we have really good data on. Children who come to the schools at kindergarten, if their parents have a college education, they bring a different set of things to the table than do children who have parents who do not have an education. Children of parents who have only a high school education, only 6% of them can count when they come to kindergarten. Where parents, if the parents are college educated, probably 40% of those children can count when they come to kindergarten. Does that make any difference if we're going to talk about universal proficiency? We know the same thing, and we have data about reading. The children who come from college-educated families have a different bag of skills related to reading, and we've got really good data on it. So what is it? If we want universal proficiency, it raises some questions about universal approach to what happens to children before they come to the schools. Our pre-kindergarten, our daycare, and so forth. If we want universal proficiency, does this ask for a different approach to what happens to those children? Of course it does. Of course it does. We also know that summertime, children of low socioeconomic, all children regress some over the summer months, more in math than reading, and children of lower socioeconomic background regress more. In fact, and I shouldn't say all children do, because there is some data that shows that children of high socioeconomic families actually grow during the summer, especially in reading. Well, you don't have to think that through very far to figure out why that might be. It's a whole lot more likely that there are books in those homes than homes in which they have a low socioeconomic status. So if we want universal proficiency, do we need to ask some questions about our school year? Do we want 3 months in which we know children will regress because of experiences they're not having that period of time? If we want universal proficiency, what is our goal? We also know that good teachers really make a difference. We know that good teachers and good principals get more done in schools where the children are having more difficulties. But we have a system set up in which, through seniority or whatever it means, the better teachers, you get choices where they go. And we don't force them, we don't assign staff where the more difficult jobs are. They get to move where they want to. And if you want universal proficiency, you would send your best people into the most difficult situations. And we don't do that. And all I'm asking, by the way, the public believes, we have polling data, 80% of the public believes that we can do what No Child Left Behind asks us to do. All children can succeed. 80% of the public believe that that can be done. That's a cross-section of those with parents and the general public. The public believes we can do. They also believe we ought to do it. And I think all of you believe it. Oregon believes that, as a matter of policy, we've had it on the books for over a decade. And all I'm trying to do is share with you a way to look at the arguments we're going to have over money, over what you should test or not test, and so forth. But what is the underlying policy that drives this discussion? And it's the public education has now been asked to focus on every child achieving universal proficiency as opposed to serving a policy of universal access. And I hope you find those thoughts interesting. And if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer.
Ozzie, I can assure you, as a former American history teacher, I enjoyed your history lesson today. And so it was beneficial. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I'm also with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Mr. Chairman, sort of moving off of what Ozzie said, the good news is we actually, despite all the discussion of funding, and those of you who serve on the Revenue Committee will have your opportunity, and we'll talk a little bit about it with you today, we are succeeding in a number of the areas despite unstable funding, despite issues of adequacy, stability, etc. Test scores are up. SAT scores are up. Dropout rates are down. Things are going well in the public schools in terms of delivery of the program and meeting the various goals that you're asking for. It's being done with less. It's being done extremely well. And I think one of the things that we've been hearing throughout the Measure 28 and the five special sessions, et cetera, is that one of the things we need to do, and we hope you'll join us in this, is to not only talk about the problems in the schools in terms of funding and other issues, but also to reassure the public that this is an outstanding public education system. Oregon is moving along ahead of the nation in many areas, along with the nation in others. We are prepared to rapidly deal with a large part of the No Child Left Behind mandates coming from the federal government, and certainly have the capability, with adequate funding, of course, to deal with all of the issues being raised by it. With that in mind, we wanted to make sure you all had a copy of the latest Oregon report card, certainly to read as you have time. But if you don't find this reassuring in terms of the state of the public schools, we'd be glad to talk to you about any of the data that is disturbing to you. It really is very good news in here in terms of what's happening. The other document we gave you that I hope you'll use throughout your committee discussions and as you look at any aspect of changes or additions, revisions of the public education system is the quality education model. You'll hear about it constantly in any committee that deals with either finance or policy related issues. This is the book. This is what they're talking about. And it's, I think you'll find it absolutely packed with information on the existing system, as well as answering questions about where we are going and where we ought to be going. It's here. And it is a remarkable document. We stand ready anytime. Frank McNamara from our office was intimately involved in developing this document, and we have more information than we and probably you all will think of asking us to provide you on it. The other thing I hope you'll use as you begin, and I'm just sort of giving you some sources, I hope, of information, is the database initiative that's available through the website or through telephoning with Brian Reeder at the Department of Education. The database initiative is one of those amazing success stories in Oregon, I think in Oregon information developed for the use of policymakers that policymakers aren't using yet. And one of the goals we've set for ourselves during this session is to encourage its use, to help any of you that want to ask questions of the existing data to get to it. You can ask very complicated questions about almost any aspect of education and get hard numbers. That is down to the district level and to the individual teacher level or administrator level, if you want to take a look at it that way. We'll also, as the department's budget is put together, be encouraging you to continue to fund this. This is an amazing tool that we just haven't really come to grips with using yet, and we hope you all will take maybe the first stab at using it. Ms. Chairman, I don't want to stop, I guess, without mentioning to you that we have given you the COSA legislative platform. It is the roadmap to quality legislation for the session, if you'd like to use it. Or you can certainly call us in and ask us what we had in mind here. But I do want to point to a couple of areas that I think are important. In the area of school finance, and I realize this is really going on in another committee, but I think as you make decisions in terms of policy, you know it has impacts on the cost of education. In the area of school finance, we have to second the remarks made by the previous panel that stable and adequate funding is essential. And we do know through the quality education model what adequacy looks like. And I think all of us understand the concept of stability. But we'd like to add a couple of other ideas to it. As you measure any bill that comes before you in either this committee or any other, that any finance plan assure equal educational opportunity for all students, regardless of the per-student property wealth. This is equity. We continue to support the concept of equity throughout the state. We certainly are absolutely committed to stable, to adequate and consistent funding, allowing for long-range program and fiscal planning. For those of you on the Revenue Committee this morning, you heard from a couple of superintendents who described for you, and I can just tell you it is consistent with what we hear from others. The last couple of sessions, particularly the last five special sessions, just make it very difficult to do the kind of planning that's necessary. And I think an example is to, I believe it was Superintendent Scherzinger from Portland, made a point that at this point, and I hadn't thought about it this way, the kinds of problems facing budgeteers in Portland or in many other districts in the state, as they try to figure out, excuse me, what to do in this year's budget, they have unresolved labor negotiations. Measure 28 remains unresolved. The legislature is in session, which always is for, and I'm sure Representative Hobson would agree that. As a former superintendent, for a superintendent, while the legislature's here setting the budget, you're wondering what the numbers are going to look like in the future. And PERS reform is up, which represents a substantial cost to the system as well, or potential cost. These are just four of the issues that are currently outstanding as districts try to put together their budgets right now. And finally, we know you'll be hearing issues on education service districts, and we continue to support their adequate and stable funding as well. In addition, Mr. Chairman, there's a batch of information on this on our position on collective bargaining, a variety of programs, personnel, et cetera, kind of the nuts and bolts of the system. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I turn it over to my colleague, John Marshall, unless you have any questions.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nolan.
I don't have questions, but I can't pass up an opportunity to alert the committee that we have the privilege of having just been joined by a group of 30 middle school students from West Sylvan Middle School. who are here today at their own initiative and at their own expense. These students raised money to rent a bus to come and observe us, watch us, make sure we're doing a good job, and to tell us that they are vitally interested in the outcome of the deliberations of this legislature, not just this committee, and I want to let them know that I appreciate their being here.
Yes, Representative Nolan, I had the pleasure of meeting four of them earlier today. So,
yes. Mr. Chair, I would add that they also are student counselors from their school with a keen interest in the political process and with some of the most intelligent comments and questions regarding public education I've heard in a long time, so I welcome them too.
Very good. Very good. John.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association, and I appreciate the opportunity to join my colleagues in here on the second week of what will hopefully be a relatively short and productive legislative session to share with you some thoughts about some guidance that we might give you as you look at bills and issues over the coming months. We've also provided you a copy of our 2003 legislative agenda, as well as a copy of our recent publication, At the Crossroads, which I think tries to put the school funding debate in some context, historical context, as well as making some arguments for adequate and stable funding of schools as drivers as we try to move Oregon's economy forward. A few thoughts I'd like to share. As you consider issues in legislation, I want you to think about the value of our Oregon's performance-based education system. It's now a little over a decade old. We have standards in place for student academic achievement. Those standards of academic achievement for students can help you gauge how well schools are doing, how well school districts are doing, and we have ways of measuring how well our students are doing. And I represent a unique group of individuals, a group of elected officials, about 1,400 of them, that are all in similar circumstances as you. They're trying to balance budgets, they're trying to satisfy constituents, and they're trying to allocate resources amongst a variety of competing yet valuable interests. And that is no easy task. They often have to say no to what they believe in their heart are good programs and good services that will, if not funded or not provided, create a detriment to the students they're trying to serve, just as the challenges that you face in having to say no to what you realize are very valuable services. The No Child Left Behind Act imposes on the nation what Oregon has already done. We've spent the last decade in creating standards and creating a valuable way to assess how well our students are doing against those standards. And I think the challenge that we face in implementing this federal law is to take what Oregon's already doing, try to bring in line the federal law, and hopefully give schools a single playbook by which they understand the rules, they understand the expectations, and we can move forward to satisfy both the provisions of Oregon law as well as the federal mandate. So I hope that as you look at issues relative to SIM and CAM, and there have been some suggested that those are not worthy efforts, I hope you'll remember that the underpinnings are standards and assessment, and that whatever you decide to do in restructuring SIM or looking at different ways to grant a reward to students that meet those standards, that you'll not forget that upset the foundation, which we believe is extremely valuable. Because we too, as elected officials, want to make sure that we have the ability to ask of the professional educators in our employ the right questions. And we need information to ask the right questions. We need information to know if our third graders aren't doing as well as reading as another school or another classroom similarly situated, what's wrong? And assessment gives us that tool. And secondarily, perhaps more importantly, a good assessment system is a diagnostic tool whereby the results come back to the teacher in the same school year, not a year later, and they can use that to identify weaknesses and restructure their teaching methods in order to meet the needs of students. There's a lot of discussion about local control. And the fact that you are now providing the bulk of funds to schools, there are some that think, well, we can serve as a 90-member school board that meets here in Salem every 2 years. We believe that you have a fiduciary responsibility to assure that the dollars you allocate are being spent wisely and efficiently. And we also believe that you have a responsibility to set the standards that you expect the public schools to meet. You are, after all, holding the purse strings, and therefore you have a right to establish expectations. But I'd like for you to think about the difference between the what and the how. While it's appropriate for you to set the standards and determine the what that public schools ought to achieve, you'd have to leave the how to individual school districts to best meet their local needs and circumstances. There are 198 school districts in Oregon, Portland with over 50,000 students, and Troy and French Glen and Double O and Harper with less than 20. So when you see bills come before you, I hope you'll think that a one-size-fits-all rubber stamp in Salem is not going to meet the needs of the Portland school district the way it is those smaller school districts And what's good for Bend is not necessarily going to be appropriate for Beaverton or Bandon or Burns. I would also hope that you would think in the bills before you not how you can impose change or improvement from Salem, but how you can create an environment to allow local folks to make the change and the improvement that you believe is appropriate and that you suggest. So there's a lot of discussion about mandates. And if you look through the list of mandates, and one definition is to go through the statutes and identify every place in the Oregon Revised Statutes that it says school district shall, that creates a mandate. And I would like to submit that that's not necessarily the case. The founders of our state in the Constitution placed in that document a clause that says the Legislative Assembly shall by law create a uniform and general system of common schools. In that phrase, the word uniformity, I think, is key, because that suggests that it's the appropriate role of the legislature to assure that there's uniformity in the delivery of educational programs around the state. And in your wisdom, we believe that you have established local school districts. You don't want to be a 90-member school board. You don't want to decide bus routes or who the principal's going to be or the superintendent or which classes are going to be taught when or what the school calendar looks like. You've decided to create a structure where those decisions are made locally. But to assure that there's some degree of uniformity and equity and equal access for all Oregon students, you've decided to establish certain guidelines. You've decided to establish standards for health and safety, our personnel, etc. So just because you have set a dictate for school districts does not necessarily make that a mandate. And the way I want you to judge what's a mandate and what's not is, as a body of elected officials, ask yourself, is this something that we should better leave to a local school board to decide? Are we trying to impose our will on, as a body of elected officials, on another body of elected officials? Are we trying to gauge or control the inputs when we ought to be focused on the outcomes? Let's judge school districts not by the number of file drawers they have in the administrative office someplace, but let's judge how what we do will affect this local school district's ability to reach those outcomes. So I'd like you to, again, before you go down the road of imposing any kind of a mandate on local school districts, ask yourselves, are we here as members of the legislature, or are we trying to be a 90-member school board? Is this issue something that ought to be decided in Salem, or is this an issue that we ought to leave to those 198 school districts, all very unique and all very different? And finally, I'd like for you to remember that public education in Oregon is a state responsibility. As I mentioned, the Constitution clearly lays out for you that you have a duty, and in fact, just a few days ago, you swore to uphold that body of law that says the Legislative Assembly shall by law provide for a uniform and general system of common schools. And what that says is that public education is clearly a state responsibility. But I would argue that the delivery of that program to boys and girls is in fact a local function. and I hope that you will recognize that. We're fortunate, I think, that of 7 members on this committee, there are 2 former school board members, 1 former teacher, and 1 former superintendent. So I think that those of you that have served in the trenches know how difficult it is to try to meet some kind of a mandate that comes from far away. And the fact exists that the best decisions are those that are made the closest to home. And we will hope that you'll follow these guidelines as you think through issues and policy decisions that you'll have over the next several months. We stand ready to help you, and we want you to be successful. And we're hopeful that when it's all said and done, we can look back and say we've made some changes and we've done some things to make our public education system even better than what it is today. With that, I'll close, Mr. Chairman. I'd be glad to respond to any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lavakian.
Thank you. Could you go back to your comments regarding local control versus what the responsibilities of the legislature are relative to that? And because there are some things that the legislature has mandated. There are some things left to local control. But in your and your association's opinion, what criteria do you think we should be using to decide which issues should be left to the districts in which we should retain control over?
Representative Vakian, let me see if I can think of an example. There are oftentimes curriculum mandates, bills introduced that will specify some particular curriculum, the use of phonics, for example, to teach kids to read. Now, we don't have any objections to phonics in all its forms, but it's our view that teaching kids to read depends on the kids that you're teaching. And professional educators in an individual classroom have to make decisions about how best to move students forward. And while you might want to suggest that phonics be available as an option, we would argue that you ought not, from Salem, mandate that particular form on every single student or classroom in the state. So I think the question is, or the answer to your question is simply, how can you best create an environment for change and improvement that you think is appropriate while recognizing that there are 198 school districts out there and 1,400 plus schools and heaven knows how many classrooms? How can you best create an environment that allows local folks to make those decisions without having those decisions imposed by from elsewhere? And by the way, Representative Avakian, if we see something that looks like a mandate, we'll let you know.
Oh, I'm going about that for a moment.
Mr. Chair, can I take a little bit of a crack at it?
Yes, definitely, Ozzie. Go ahead.
Again, Ozzie Rose and Representative Avakian. I think that you have an advantage over your colleagues a couple decades ago, and that's with the our ability to gather data now and with the focus on what do you want from your schools, what are the outcomes. You set the outcomes. That's not a mandate. We want this kind of production. The mandate is when you delve into trying to tell us how to get the outcome. And we're arguing strongly that local people, what you do to meet the reading outcome that we expect of schools in one community may be different in another because of the kinds of children they're serving. We've got we have data now that we've never used to have, and we know lots of stuff about how kids learn, et cetera, et cetera. And you need to tell the schools, here's what we expect, and then let them figure out how to get it done. And it's become harder and harder to keep that at the forefront because you provide most of the money now. That's your argument here is we're writing the checks, so we need to call some of the... and we coined a phrase a couple sessions ago that trying to respond to that, we need a state system of schools, not a state school system. And you can have the uniformity that the Constitution asks for, and you can have the commonness that it asks for, and you can have the results you want under a state system of schools, probably, in our view, better than if you have a state school system. And so, for me, the mandate is to tell us how to do it in a prescriptive way. That's a mandate. If it says, here's what our expectation, then that's up to us to figure out how to do it.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Follow-up.
To make sure I understand what I think you're saying is, in whatever action we take, allow school boards and districts the flexibility to develop a curriculum that they think is best for their community and meeting the outcomes we demand.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah. Okay.
a comment about mandates, and Ozzie, maybe you can tell us about the conversation that we had. I'm interested in mandates that could be considered to be unfunded, or mandates that we could consider to be regulatory burdens upon schools. And if I'm not mistaken, Ozzie, you have a survey in progress among your administrators. Could you tell us about that?
Specifically to the issue of whether the SIM and CAM ought to be, what's it cost you to the SIM and CAM, et cetera. That, you know, there's lots of noise around here, and I think you got some bills about we need to do away with the SIM and CAM. And we have a survey in the field. The State Department's also using a database. We're trying to bring those two things together to show what the SIM and CAM do for us or cost us. And that's the most common one. By the way, the most expensive mandates, the two most expensive mandates are PERS and collective bargaining. I mean, they tell us of some specific things we have to do. Now, I'm not proposing you do either one of them, by the way. But if you talk about mandates, yeah, I'm not covered by PERS, as my colleague is. But that, I only use it to illustrate, just to say mandates, and we'll do away with the ones that cost. You may not want to, they may, et cetera, et cetera. But yes, we have a. Frank is now working with the State Department trying to mesh the numbers, and we'll have some stuff for you.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might, we've done quite a bit of work with a couple of your colleagues on trying to identify mandates and where the various sources of those mandates are. So at some future meeting, I'd be glad to share the results of that. Jan McComb, the administrator of the Senate Education Committee, spent, I think it was last interim or perhaps the interim before, on listing every single statute in at least the education law that where every time it says school district shall, and that list is available, and we've tried to winnow that list and put those mandates or dictates, if you want to call them that, in some understandable form, and I've even got a color chart that I think is valuable, and I'd be glad to share that with you perhaps at another meeting, and we can sort of try to rationalize the difference between what we call a good one and a bad one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, John, I think I had Jan's list, and for those in the audience, this single-spaced, and it's 6 pages, of mandates. At least this is entitled Oregon K-12 Statutory Mandates. And it would be my hope that we could find some that are regulatory burdens and burdens on schools and that are not helpful. And we would like to look at those, if there are those, more than one, and make some decisions about them. If this would help schools operate, we would be all for that. Operate better, we would be all for that. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
John and Chuck have got a really good template for how to look at that question and how to organize that. And, we also have mandates coming from statutory, administrative. We also have mandates coming from counties. And see, the mandate issue is a, and mm-hmm. I think you'd be well served to let them come back and share that. They've done a really good job of sorting that out. Mm-hmm. Better way to talk about it.
Yeah, we'd be very interested. Yes, Representative Dalton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rose, can you elaborate on what sort of mandates you have from counties? Some examples, please.
Fees when we want to build buildings. Fees, payment for elections. That to them, that's probably not a mandate. I mean, one man's mandate is another man's necessity, but...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. You bet. Okay, I might, we're talking about schools, I might comment on something I've said for many, many, many years about schools. I've said, and I hope our students in the audience could or would agree, that any kid or any student who really wanted a good education in our public schools can get one. And a lot of our students really do want a good education. My concern has been, what about those who are not quite so dedicated or committed to that goal? But in any case, I've always been a pro-public education person because I think we could put our graduates, of those who really want a good education, up against anybody, and we would do very well, and we have done very well. So whatever that's worth, at this time anyway, in this conversation. But well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Vicki, would you like to come up? We're going to hear about the Teacher Standards and Practices Department, and Vicki will introduce herself and make a presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Vicki Chamberlain. I'm the new Executive Director of the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. I've been there since June. My predecessor was there 13 years, and then he was there 13 years before that as the deputy. So I have a lot of catching up to do. I came with an overview of the commission and our activities, and I don't have a lot of policy advice for you today. But I hope you have some questions for me. I brought you a lot of materials, and I will occasionally refer to them. I brought you a blue booklet that talks about all of our educator programs except for one from the University of Phoenix, which trains administrators. And I brought you a brochure, which is a summary of our activities. I brought you a supply and demand report that was done on teachers and where we have shortages. And that's up till today, not counting retirements. I brought you a charter school registry, which I'll refer to, which is the statutory mandate that we report to you. And then I also brought for you a handout that is a copy of the website at the Oregon University Systems that has the reports that we've done for the last 5 years related to teachers, teacher quality, education, and it's actually really fun, if you're into that, to get into it and see what we've done. When I'm done, I have a copy of my comments for your records. A lot of folks want to know what the commission is. It is a small state agency. It's independent. It was the very first teacher licensure board in the nation. It was started in 1965, and it was within the Department of Education. And then in 1973, with the help of Del Parnell, it became an independent agency, and this year we'll celebrate our 30th anniversary of being an independent agency. Mr. Marshall referred to professional educators making decisions in the classroom. That's precisely what it is. It's a professional licensure board, and when people don't get it, I'm a former teacher, and I'm a member of the Oregon Bar, and all I have to do is say it's like a mini Oregon Bar. Very similar functions, licensure and discipline and those types of things, and set the standards. There are only 12 independent licensure boards in the nation, just so that you know. The size and the makeup of the commission, inside the little brochure is our current commission, who we have. We have 8 teachers, 4 administrators. We have 1 faculty from private higher ed, 1 faculty from public higher ed, 1 school board member, and 2 public members. At least one of my 17 commissioners has to be an expert in special education. So, and to be qualified, the educators on our commission have to have a current active valid license, and they have to have taught or been an administrator recently on that license. So our folks are pretty highly qualified. The term is 3 years, and they're appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. A lot of folks ask about our funding. TSPC is 100% other funds. No general funds come into our agency. All of our budget is generated through licensure fees or licensure-related fees. We do get occasionally some federal money and grants that help us do some of these research reports. And so the legislature, however, we're going to go through ways and means, has to give us permission to spend our money, so even though we collect it. I just have to make a comment, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair, about these students. If this is a reflection of our future, I'm pretty excited. I think the folks here today were really wonderful. And I'll let them all know I'm not the least bit offended that they're leaving this presentation. Uh-huh. we have three statutory duties. Our first one is to set the standards for and license educators. Our second one is to maintain professional standards, which ends up being the discipline arm of our work. And then our final one is to adopt the standards for the teacher education programs in Oregon. And so we're like a mini state accrediting board. No teacher education program in Oregon can operate unless they've first been accredited by the Office of Degree Authorization, which is another little-known state agency that has a lot to do with education in the state, public and private. There are 18 staff members. There is my position, two professionals, and 15 support staff. We have three evaluators that evaluate 19,000 licenses a year. And we have three public service reps, two answer the phone, and one answers email. And so the rest runs our internet services and other things like that. And so our mail, high volume of mail, obviously getting applications. We have 75,000 active licenses in Oregon. That's not a head count, because an educator could have a teaching license and an administrator license, or maybe even a counseling license. So it's a little difficult to gauge. However, there are about 36,000 licensed educators in the public schools today. 26,000 of those are teachers. And so that gives you an idea of the picture. It's dropped a little this year. I know that the Oregon Education Association reported to me that they lost 1,000 members. And so that means those are active licensed educators out there without jobs right now in the public schools. We have, there are almost about 2,000 of our licensed folks in private schools. The charter school registration is there are 27 educators who are registered in the charter school registration. And two sessions ago, the legislature said that if a educator was going to work in a charter school and they did not hold an active Oregon teacher license, they had to register with us, which means that they have to give us a resume and submit fingerprint cards and go through that kind of background check. And then the legislature, I don't know the reason for this, and Jim Green might when he comes next week and talks to you about charter schools, why the legislature asked us to come back and report the number of registrations that we have. This is our last session. So there are 27. And what I do know of that is that at least 50% of the teachers in a charter school have to be licensed. And so one of the reasons that it is low, in my opinion, is that many of the charter schools have fully licensed staff. And Mr. Grange will have better figures on that. So just a little picture of our workload. I kind of gave you a picture of our staff, is that we average around 19,000 licenses a year. About 3,000 to 5,000 of those are brand new licenses, either from out of state or in state, and the rest of them are renewals. And again, it's really difficult to get a head count, because you go, oh, 26,000 employed people, how can you do 19,000? Well, if I have an administrator license, it'll expire at a different time than my teaching license. And so this is a reflection of the activity on the 75,000 number. In 1998, our year that we measure things is the school year. And in 1998-99, we had just about 4,000 emails. Well, last year, we had 16,000 emails. And so that's how much the web has changed or shifted our service. We average over 40,000 telephone calls a year. Now, I have to tell you this. When I asked for this job, everyone said, why do you want that job? You can never get through to that agency. And when I came in, I discovered that we had six incoming lines. It worked on a symphony system, and when it got full, everybody got a busy signal. And if any of you have ever waited for an internet provider, when somebody waits to get to the telephone and the live person, they want to make sure all their questions get answered. And so our phone calls tend to average a fairly long time. Starting in January, I asked the staff to set up a voicemail system. I said, why should you get a busy signal? Why can't I call in, and if the lines are busy, I can leave a voicemail, and at least I've gotten through. In the first 4 days of the voicemail system, we had over 500 voicemails. So that shows me that 40,000 are just the folks that got through, and now we're going to have a really good look at our the folks trying to reach us. something else that we did is when I arrived, the phones were answered from 10 to 5, and that was so that folks could return voice messages from 8 to 10, but that didn't make any sense to me because I used to teach, and the only time I could get to a phone was before school and after school. So we now answer the phones from 7:30 to 5:30, and it has really eased, obviously, the voicemail and the messages. And finally, on workload in the discipline area, we have nearly 200 formal complaints a year regarding educators. The statute in that we have to abide by requires us to investigate every complaint. There is no discretionary decision making in our office to say, gee, that just doesn't seem to rise to the level of something we have to spend resources on. So I would say about nearly a third of those complaints result in no further action or a dismissal at their first appearance in front of the commission. But we have about 100 ongoing all the time active either investigations or types of discipline matters. We settle many of these. Our forms of discipline are public reprimand, a probationary period possibly, a suspension or a revocation. So, and there are only a few instances when an educator can permanently have their license revoked, and those are when they have committed what we call a list of the mandatory crimes, and they're all extremely egregious, the murder and the abuse and larceny. They're all felonies, and we don't get many of those, thank goodness. We do get a few, and those are the ones that you usually see in the newspaper. I'm not going to go over this in gory detail. It's very easy to read the supply and demand report. I brought it because it's of interest. As I told you, we have 75,000 active licenses and 26,000 actively employed educators, and yet we have shortages in Oregon. And our shortages are specific to where people are teaching, not necessarily specific to bodies, and where and what. So we have shortages in special education, music, English as a second language, bilingual, counseling, math, library media, science, and most second languages. And then our shortages geographically end up being eastern Oregon, the southern reaches of Oregon, surprisingly Representative Hobson's district. We have shortages and up in the north coast area, and I say surprisingly because I like Astoria, so but Clatsop County tends to be an area reported where people are having difficulty hiring. And it's a matter of getting people to come out to these small communities that Mr. Marshall was referring to and moving. Most folks want to live in the town where they graduated if they're Oregon educated. So we tend not to have problems around where the teacher education programs are. There's only one teacher preparation program east of the mountains, and that's Eastern Oregon University. They're all the rest here in the valley.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Farr.
For the record, Representative Hobson taught in Tillamook, and we all from Tillamook know that Tillamook is better than Astoria.
You know what? I like Tillamook, too. I had the pleasure in my old life. I used to be the community college administrator, and I did some work at community colleges, but I did the search for the Tillamook Bay Community College president, the last one we have, and I think you got a good one. I just have to say that. It's wonderful. I guess I have just a few more comments to make. We have 18 programs in Oregon that offer teacher education. 12 of them are private and 6 of them are public. So quite a lot of times people don't think about our private schools offering this type of education, but they filled the gap when our higher ed system was having financial troubles a decade and a half ago. There, one of the brochures I brought you is a synopsis of the private education programs. It's very similar to what's in this brochure, except for it's updated because this is about a year and a half old. And what this also will tell you is whether or not the program offered is an undergraduate program or a master's program, and that is the source of huge debate these days. Is should I go through my undergraduate and get my major in math and then take a year in a teacher education program as a master's and become a teacher, or should I take my math major infused with my education classes and come out as an undergraduate and teach? And the research shows that the brand new teachers who come out through either path have the same amount of success. There's no edge, in other words, by acquiring your master's degree in the education program. So that's kind of an interesting statistic. I want to talk a little bit about teacher quality. I think we're Representative Backlund said it. I'm pretty much Oregon grown and educated. I went to public schools here, and I got my bachelor's at Western Oregon, and I got my master's at Oregon State, and I got my law degree at Willamette, and I am very proud of my education in Oregon and always have been. So I think sometimes we get defensive when people attack education, but we have the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission has had extremely high standards for teachers for a long time. Today, every single teacher and administrator must pass a basic skills test. And to teach, you have to pass a praxis test, which is owned by the Education Testing Service in your content area. Oregon has among the highest cut scores in the nation on those tests, and we get complaints about that a lot, that those were the standards that were set. The standards are set by educators who are teaching now, teacher preparation educators, coming together and looking at the curriculum that's being taught in the K-12 schools and saying, this is what we believe our teachers need to know. And part of our duty then is to make sure those tests are current, accurate, and aligned with what's going on in today's content area. And I would submit to you we have work to do in that area. We did that work initially. Now we have to go back and look and see if they're still aligned. And that will be part of my budget request, which I doubt that you'll see except for as a voter on the floor, I think. So. And all teachers must complete a teacher education program. So when we talk about alternative routes, you can get out of a bachelor's degree program here in Oregon, and you can have a district ask to get a license for you, but then by the end of the 3 years that we're going to give you on that license, you have to have completed a teacher preparation program to get your full license in Oregon. So that's part of our accountability and high standards. So I think we're pretty proud of that, actually. The other thing that I would tell you about that is our brand new licensure system is performance-based, and that's sort of new in this nation. When I got my teaching license, all I had to do was have my bachelor's degree in my major and be recommended. Now, if I were a brand new teacher, I would come out and I would get my initial license like I got in the old days, but to get my permanent license to teach forever, I'm going to have to prove that I can show student learning gains. And we call those advanced competencies. So I have to prove that I can take whatever class of students you give me, and it's the one I have if I'm employed, and that I can take each one of those students through learning games, which is highly relevant to No Child Left Behind now and some of the comments that Ozzy made about what we do with students. We're really proud of that license, and we have some controversy around it. And I think it's legitimate controversy. We implemented it very quickly. It's expensive for people to go back and do postgraduate work. The first thing that gets cut in districts is your staff development money. And teachers are under enormous load and stress to teach these days in their first beginning years. And what Ozzy said about seniority and teachers being placed, our brand new teachers with the least amount of experience are getting the toughest classes. And then we're asking them that within 6 years they have to achieve these advanced competencies. So, and then we have all our unemployed folks who are supposed to achieve these advanced competencies, and they're not in the classroom to gain the skills to do that. So we have some work to do. A bill I absolutely believe will come to your committee. I asked Representative Backlund to introduce it would be a bill that would eliminate the statutory timelines to let us work out the kinks around all those issues I just raised. We haven't seen it yet. We're waiting for it, so. We have partners with all the agencies, the public folks, the Oregon University System, and the Department of Education. And I have to apologize. I don't know where you are on learning about No Child Left Behind, but we have a partnership with ODE that this commission will take charge of the highly qualified teacher aspect of our No Child Left Behind plan. And the commission's taken the position that every licensed teacher in Oregon who is properly assigned, in other words, teaching on their license, is highly qualified. And we believe we can defend that based on the standards that we've had for people to get licensed. So our recent achievements are we too have a database initiative on the website. You can go to our website, which is on the front of the brochure, anytime, and you can go under online services and look at teacher inquiry. You can type in any name, and you don't need a social security number, and up will come a screen that will tell you where the person's employed, if we know that, and what their exact licensure is and what their endorsement areas are. And this is a very good public accountability piece in terms of people wanting to know whether their teachers are properly licensed and properly assigned. So we're pretty happy about that. Let's see. Our challenges, I think, are to get up to speed. One of the things we don't have, and because it's a data input and it's a staff issue, is the credential of all our educators in our electronic system. We have that on files, but we haven't inputted, for example, if they have a bachelor's and a master's and that sort of thing. And that's information that districts are going to have for No Child Left Behind. So we have to do that. We have the alignment issue I was talking to you about, and processing our licenses more quickly. There are times when we are 30 days behind. We allow a 120-day grace period after a license is expired, so no educator is harmed by our speed. So, and implementing our new licensure system. So those are pretty much my comments. That's the work we do and who we are, and I would welcome any questions.
Mr. Chair. Representative Scott.
I would like to go back to your comments in reference to your investigations of the alleged infractions that they may have. With the collective bargaining agreements that are in place, do they come primarily after the fact that they've gone through the collective bargaining, or who may bring those to you, to the commission?
I'm assuming, Representative Scott, that you are referring to like the grievance procedure portion of their collective bargaining.
Yes.
This is how we do it. An administrator has an affirmative duty to report to us immediately anytime they think an educator has violated the standards. And there are ethical standards, which include lying and falsifying and how you treat students, clear up to the criminal activities. They're to report that to us immediately. If the district is engaged in an ongoing investigation, we just step back until they've completed their investigation because there isn't any point in duplicating that kind of effort. We'll use their investigation if possible in addition to work that we'll do. If it goes to another forum, which is through the grievance procedure or the Fair Dismissals Board, or if it's in criminal court, we'll wait till that has been completed because sometimes folks are not guilty. And then there isn't any point in proceeding in an action against their license. So sometimes these get fairly drawn out. We have, it's in statute and in administrative rule, any educator who's in that situation, their license continues till it's absolutely decided what the outcome is, so they're not suspended or out of work. They're innocent till proven guilty, so to speak. So does that help?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, Vicki, I'd like to say how delighted the educational field is that you accepted that position, even applied for and wanted it. There's some question about why, but I think it really portends well for the future, and I'm delighted you're there.
Thank you.
I have one question in regard to your agreement with ODE to take over the evaluation or the verification of highly qualified teachers under NCLB. Does that mean that you will be negotiating with the feds in that regard, or are you assuming that your qualifications will meet theirs? How does that process work?
Well, Pat Burke and Superintendent Castillo have been wonderful in terms of doing the partnership. The federal law says the state education agency is responsible for the state plan. The federal law also assumes that all licensure responsibilities are within those state agencies. They just obviously didn't think through, because there's only 12 professional licensure boards. So how that will work is we will defend our position in a way that will work into ODE's state plan. So I've hired a legal researcher, actually, because we just didn't have the time to match the federal definitions up against our competencies to prove to say that Representative Backlund, for example, and you who were licensed under the old system are as highly qualified as our new performance-based teachers, which meet the federal definitions really clearly. So our duty is to make sure the state can submit their plan and have it be supported. And if we don't, I know exactly what they'll do. They'll do what they need to do, and that's do it themselves. But we won't let that happen.
Vicki, I have a hypothetical for you. If you could make...
I'm new.
If you could have your druthers and you could make one change that you would consider a positive one, what would it be? And if you could get rid of something that now is imposed on or is a responsibility of TSPC, what would that be?
What would I change and what would I get rid of? I would change our administrative rules. I think they have become very complex and detailed and difficult to navigate and not as organized as I would like. And that will require some time for me to see how they work against some of our factual situations. If I could do that immediately, I would do that immediately. In terms of mandates, I frankly do not feel burdened as an agency. The mandates that set up our commission were very general grants of authority, and I don't think there's anything that I go, oh my goodness, I wish I didn't have to do that. Mm-hmm. It took about 15 minutes to pull up the data to do my report to you, which was a mandate. And so I can't think of anything that I would change. That's not correct. I would change the perception of our ability to deliver high-quality service. But as far as the legislature goes, I just can't think of anything that I'd pull out of there. I think there's some old things in there we need to look at, but I think they're well conceived.
I would say that, in fact, I was just talking this morning to a couple of legislators, and they were complaining that teachers had, or they were explaining to me that teachers had complained to them about the phone not being answered and about there not being a flex schedule. But you touched on both of those as you went through your presentation. So you have probably addressed those more than my legislator or colleague realizes.
Yes, I'm hoping it even gets better, frankly. We've asked for one more public service representative. I think I already said that, to answer the phones. I think that'll help with this voicemail situation. We have to be responsive.
Well, very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. And we have our last presentation of today, Tamara Haas from the Columbia Regional Autism Services. You've been very patient. We thank you for that.
Well, I feel like I thought the greatest day to come on here, being able to just simply TSPC as licensed educator. I know that I've accessed that permission a lot to just get some of my questions answered. It's been very helpful. And then also the kids, that is great as an educator, seeing how these young people are really interested in wanting to get their foot in the door and understanding public policies and knowledge. So anyway... again, my name is Tamara Haas, and I first of all want to thank you very much for allowing me to come and provide an overview of regional programs. And right now you're being distributed a copy of just basically my testimony. And thank you, and I have a great appreciation and respect for what each and every one of you guys do out there. So thank you. All right. So I'm going to basically begin with an overview of what regional programs are. And feel free to kind of interrupt me and ask questions. I have a sense that I'm going to be as linear as a laser. So just go ahead and chime in and present me a question. First of all, regional programs were created in the early 80s to make sure every school district in the state had access to specialists who served children with what we consider low-incidence disabilities. They were created in a way that made sense to taxpayers and schools. I am here today to say that regionals have successfully done what they were designed to do, equalize services across the state. And today, when budgets are tight and this kind of efficient delivery of services, it is more important now than ever to have this type of direct service. So what are regional programs? There are eight
regional programs throughout the state. And as I mentioned, I serve as an autism specialist for Columbia Regional, which serves Multnomah, Clackamas, Hood River, and Wasco counties. Regional support our school districts to educate children who are visually impaired, hard of hearing, severely orthopedically impaired, and students with autism spectrum disorder. And thousands of children fall into each of these categories all over the state, and I am sure that you have many families of children with children who are suffering with these types of disabilities.
Tamara, excuse me, yes. Back to your first real paragraph, low incidence then could have been followed with high cost? Is that not so? Or?
Well, that's a very good question. Low incidence would be basically these disabilities don't surface in the general population all that frequently. So it's not as though we have mass resources to just address their needs right off the start. So having an area of specialists to access is essential, and yes, you're right, that does cost money. Now, it's especially more difficult for some of our more rural areas where they may only have a few children with extremely high needs, such as autism spectrum disorder, and limited access to kind of a school or a regional program of specialists who can serve them. And before regional programs were developed in the 80s, they had something called consortiums. And that benefited the more metropolitan areas because they could they would have a high number of students with these types of disabilities, and therefore they could be someone could help them. They could be there to field questions and provide services. But in some of the rural areas, the districts are pretty much left on their own. And so the concept behind regionals is that it would equalize or reduce the disparity of service across the state and be more cost effective, if that makes sense. Okay, that's a very winded answer.
It does. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Not so far? Okay. So, and as I mentioned, I'm going to be talking from the point of view of an autism specialist with Columbia Regional Services, since that is pretty much where my expertise lies. And with Columbia Regional Program, we currently have 1,137 students with autism spectrum disorder enrolled in our program.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dalton.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Before we move on to the next point, the services, I'll go back to the regional programs. Can you give me an idea, or could you give the committee an idea, where the regional programs are located in the state?
I can give you an idea of where they're located in the west side. And we have Columbia Regional Program, which, as I mentioned, services Multnomah County, Wasco, Clackamas, Hood River. We have Northwest Regional Educational Service District, which sometimes the more western areas will access that. They do have autism specialists there. And then we have other regional programs throughout the state to meet the needs of, you know, maybe our east areas, like Baker City or something. And any other questions?
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, follow up.
So what I think I hear you saying is that you have a combination of ESDs providing this service, and in your case, the Columbia Regional Program sort of mm-hmm. takes the place of what an ESD might provide, say, in another part of the state?
Yeah. The one nice thing about the regional program is that, for example, when you have a regional program, then the specialists there are very focused, for example, say, on autism. And they have the libraries, the mass amount of information, especially in the field of autism, comes their way, and they're able to cross-reference with each other to meet the needs of the kids that they're serving. An educational service district would have more along the lines of a variety of different specialists that maybe not like a huge library of resources or real concentrated areas. So, for example, the regional program would hit your real low-incidence populations like autism, folks who have deaf, they call the deaf-blind population, things like that, where it's very specific.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm trying to understand this. I suppose it could. We could say that the Multnomah County area has an independent service provider, the Columbia Regional Program, because we have such a large population that you would have, you know, a large need for this service, and so because they're clustered together, you'd have a service provider do that, as opposed to perhaps a less populated area in the state that you wouldn't have the sort of conglomeration of needs, so that, you know, the ESDs would be able to effectively serve those communities. Is that the appropriate characterization?
Right, and within the regional programs, the if you are in an area where there aren't a high number of students, say with autism, then it'd be a lot of financial stress on that district, say, to hire a autism specialist just to serve those three kids. But what they would do would be to access a regional program. So, for example, we go to Hood River or you know, the more outlying areas, because to hire someone to serve like 0.1 FTE, a tenth of a day, or to go and, or a tenth of a week, a couple hours a day, just to go serve those few kids, wouldn't be a realistic thing. It'd be very expensive. Or to send the child to, say, a residential school, that would be extremely expensive. And so, for example, in Washington, the state of Washington does not have regional programs. And what happens there is, A, the children are not provided with a quality education service that they deserve under Individuals with Disabilities Educational Act, or now the No Child Left Behind Act. The child service is limited, or they're put into a residential facility, which is very expensive. And so if you compare Oregon and Washington, Washington without the regional programs, those kids don't get the level of service that, say, children in Oregon do, because we have kind of these think tanks, these groups that people can access, and it equalizes the service throughout the state. So even the kiddos out in the rural area who are very impacted, say, by autism, or are extremely orthopedically impaired, and there's not a specialist just for that area, they can access through the region.
Mr. Chair, one final question?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hass, so has it been your experience that people are moving their families with autistic children to the Portland metro area because they maybe haven't had the degree of care that they would want in another part of the state, so they move in to seek better services?
I've heard stories of that, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, any other questions?
Please continue.
Okay, great. So going back to basically a lot of what Representative Dolfo just asked me, what do autism services do specifically? Well, they address the educational needs of students with autism spectrum disorder, which are extremely diverse and require a wide range of services. So this disability is very unique, and if you're not around it and know the characteristics really well, like, say, an autism specialist would, then it's really difficult for people, even who have their special education license or their handicapped learner's license, to kind of get their arms around and understand what this children, the behaviors behind this children. So having someone who's a specialist and sees the type of behavior all the time and reads about it and is kind of inundated with all the new information, then that person is able to support these teams through problem solving with these kids. And so, again, even those with special education certification are not always equipped to provide all the services without training and technical assistance. And when these services are not provided, students with autism spectrum disorder often have significant behavior problems and do not make the adequate progress as required, again, by IDEA or the Individual with Disabilities Educational Act. And more recently, and which was mentioned a lot today, the No Child Left Behind Act. We can't just look away from these kids. They deserve the right to have specialists support them and to have a free and appropriate public education. So, and you have to understand, again, something about autism. The amount of research and new information increases daily. This is a huge thing right now, if you will, that we need to really understand and prepare our kids through educational programming, adequate diagnosis and assessment. And if you're not around it every day, then you just don't understand the characteristics that are really unique to this wide spectrum disability. Again, it's an autism spectrum disability, so you could have a child who's very low functioning, kind of your classic child with autism, all the way up to a child who's extremely bright and presents with something called Asperger's but is falling through the cracks at the school level because his educational program is not in place to meet his unique learning style. And that's where autism specialists come in and just really kind of guide teams, parents, children through adequate programming for students with this disability. And in addition, our regional program, our regional programs are also designed to be able to provide workshops and in-services to staff. Parents have been involved with these in the past to basically kind of build some capacity and a knowledge base to send information out. And we've been working on this a long time to build intra-district capacity and knowledge about, say, for example, autism. But it's really difficult because these kids tend to pop up here and there, and they present with very wide range a wide range of disabilities and things that kind of take people by surprise. And they, according to research, adhere to or do better with certain types of structures and supports in place. And once they're in place, we see a child learning. And when they're pulled, we see behaviors escalating, which requires a lot of school resources to get that back under control. Okay? Mm-hmm. And so specialists also play a key role in the assessment and diagnosis of children with autism in the educational setting. And the eligibility determinations are becoming increasingly more difficult because of the complexity of the behaviors and problems that the students are exhibiting. So again, when you talk about a disorder that's a spectrum of different deficits that surface, especially at the school level, whether it's academic or social or something called sensory, then all of these issues need to be addressed before we can really have this child be a good learner. And with the goal being that we help this child become a future productive member of our society. And by teaching him how to take care of himself or teaching her and her family how to access services, then when they're graduating and exiting the educational system, they will be more equipped to be members of our society. Okay. So I understand this is not the committee to talk about funding, but I want to make sure you understand why regional programs were created in the first place. Without regional programs, school districts, again, would be forced to go out on their own and find trained specialists to treat children with these unique sets of needs. This would pose a significant problem for two reasons. First, small districts simply wouldn't have the money to hire full-time specialists. Therefore, in order to maintain efficiency, they would need to form the consortiums that I was talking about earlier, which that basically led up to the development of regionals in the first place. And second, if we go back to providing services by way of consortiums, there will be disparity in the services provided throughout our state. It would be maybe our more densely populated areas could afford to hire a full-time specialist, but our more rural areas would not. And so those kids over there would really be not receiving the amount of education or educational structure necessary to meet their needs.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dalton.
Just an observation. Last legislative session, the 2001 session, you know, we would get calls in this building, particularly from the South Coast and the Mid Coast, where folks were losing their autism coordinators, and so their families were really sort of exasperated about what they were going to do, and their only options were to say drive into the larger population areas like Roseburg or Eugene to get services for children in Coos Bay. It's a horrible situation. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that Ms. Hass brought up at least the sort of concept of funding. A question, I suppose, are you able to speak to sort of how the funding situation has affected your organization the last legislative mm-hmm. session, 2001, and there were some individual cuts to those mm-hmm. those service areas? Maybe you could speak to that.
Yeah, I believe in the governor's budget, regional programs were cut by about 3%. And so, yeah, there has been some impact, and that's one of the reasons I'm here today, is just to kind of explain to people what regional programs are. And so as you go out and you are making decisions around policy, especially policy related to education, that you do understand that this population is out there. And Oregon has a very high incidence per capita of students diagnosed with autism, as it sounds like Representative Dalto knows. And they are throughout the state. House Bill 5015 is something I'll make you aware of. It's going through Ways and Means. It's just something you may want to know about. But it does talk about grants and aids, and regional programs kind of fall under that. So when you are out, I guess, collaborating and having lunch with your colleagues, it might be something that you explain to them. Because what my sense is that when I say, oh, I work for a regional program, it's just kind of people aren't really sure what that means. And so I think that maybe step one is just saying, here's what it is, here's what it does for a population out there who really does need some services, parents and families who I can guarantee you are in each and every one of your districts and are just pretty much at their wits' end, especially in the rural areas, because they're saying, who out here knows how to handle my child? Do I manage him at home? Should I be looking for residential placement? And that's expensive stuff. And so when we have all of our ducks in a row and do have places in the rural areas for families to access, that's very important. And also with No Child Left Behind and IDEA, the Individual Disabilities Educational Act, ADA, all those things say that in our society these children have a right to be here in our schools and receiving a public education that every other child has been offered also, free, appropriate public education. And so those are very, very important things and kind of speak to the heartstrings of a lot of families right now who are truly in crises, trying to just figure out, how do I manage a child with autism?
Thank you.
And just briefly, as Representative Hobson probably does know this, that regionals have the support of the Special Education Task Force, and which the legislature funded last session. In addition, surveys completed by the district superintendents around the state indicated regional services are a priority for their districts. So again, I'm asking you to support and recognize regionals as a cost-effective way to serve the children in our state, and to just kind of keep it in mind and explain to your colleagues what it is if it comes up as you are setting policy throughout the next biennium. Thank you for your time.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a comment, and thanking Tamara for coming. The other thing is, the governor's budget with just a 3% cut, as we all know, is not going to be the final close of session budget. So I would ask that you keep this material for maybe a later presentation in front of Ways and Means.
Right. Thank you. And I believe Ways and Means will be reviewing House Bill 5015 the week of March 10th. So those are times when, if we want to really connect with our legislators and talk about these kiddos out there that are, really kind of, I don't want to say overlooked, but they tend to be overlooked, they need advocacy, and they need people to understand them and their families. Thank you, Representative Hoffman, for bringing that up. Any more questions?
Well, Tamara, we very much appreciate this information, and it's been an education, and that's what our name is. We are the Education Committee, so we're delighted that you could present for us today.
Thank you so much for having me and for hearing me out.
Okay. With that, colleagues, then we will adjourn our meeting.